This is the Jabberjaw Podcast Network.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Lead Singer Syndrome, a podcast where myself, Shane Told, speaks to other lead singers about what it's like to front a professional rock and roll band. And right now, I am very tired. I just got off a plane. It was 14 and a half hours from Vancouver to Brisbane, Australia. And before that, we had to fly from Toronto to Vancouver. So I've been in transit for almost 24 hours. So you can imagine what that feels like. Well, maybe you can't. It's hard if you haven't done it. It's kind of hard to really imagine. But I guess right now at home, it's like 6:30 p.m. in Toronto. And here it's like 8:30 p.m. but the next day, so I flew and I completely missed a day. So it's Monday now, but when you're listening to this, I don't even think it will be, I don't know, I think it'll be the same time. Hey, I'm tired, I'm confused, but it's all good. Because this week we have a great episode with Mr. Keith Buckley of Every Time I Die. Such an interesting person. I mean, not only has he been the frontman of Every Time I Die for, since 1998, I want to say. He was also a part of a super group called The Damn Things, and recently he's tried his hand at writing. He has a novel out. It's called Scale. I've read it. It's terrific. You guys should definitely check it out. Also, he's had some pretty scary stuff go on in his personal life over the last, less than a year, so we get into that stuff and a whole lot more, and this conversation is very deep. Keith's known for being on stage. He's being like a funny guy. This interview is pretty serious, and very, very eye-opening, and I learned a lot just from talking to Keith, and this is definitely one of my favorite podcast episodes to date. Before we get into it, as always, I'd just like to say thank you for all the support, all the love, all the emails, all the Snapchats that you guys are sending me. It's really cool. Like, I know I asked, like, hey, go on Snapchat, send a video or a picture of, like, you listening to my podcast, and that's been really cool. I've tried to get back to everybody. Sorry if I somehow missed you. I know I have quite the queue now, especially after being on an airplane for the last 22 hours. But please keep those coming. Snapchat is Real Shane Told. I know it's a bit of a douchey name, but Shane Told was taken. What are you going to do? And if you want to just get in touch with regular old email, it's leadsingersyndrome@gmail.com. Also, make sure you check out Instagram. I always post pictures, relevant pictures of stuff going on that we talk about in the show. That's @leadsingersyndrome. And if you just want to fire me off something real quick on Twitter, it's @leadsingersyn, S-Y-N. Also, if you want to help out the show, I know I say it every week, but it's really, really easy. If you buy anything online at all, if you use Amazon, please just use our affiliate link. It's leadsingersyndrome.com/Amazon. Takes you right to the Amazon homepage. You log in as normal. Anything you buy, we get 4%. So it really, really adds up. So if you're going to use Amazon, just throw us a bone because it costs you nothing. The link again, leadsingersyndrome.com/Amazon. And lastly, to all the Australian listeners listening to this, please come out and see us on tour. We're here. We're here in Australia. You know, we don't get a chance to come out that often. It's a great lineup. We're with Pierce the Veil, they're headlining, then us, then our very, very good friends in Beartooth. It is a great show, so please come out. And if you do come out, I'll be hanging out at the merch table. We play right before Pierce the Veil, so once we're done, I'm going to hop out to the merch table. So please, if you listen to the show, come out, say hi. I love to meet whether they're fans of Silverstein, whether they're fans of Lead Singer Syndrome, it's all good. I love meeting people, so please come say hi. Well, that's all for the intro. Thank you so much for listening to this. Here is a great conversation with Keith Buckley of Every Time I Die. Hold it right up to your face.
Phallic. This is one of the most phallic mics I've ever seen.
That's one, yeah. That's a hell of a
it's
mic, though.
And everything. Okay.
Sweet. I Dr. Phil. That's good.
It's kind of, I'm a creature of habit on this tour, and Dr. Phil is one of my, like...
That's your go-to?
It's, yeah, I'll make sure that I'm around Dr. Phil if possible. I was just at home. Are we rolling? I'll tell.
We're always rolling. Okay. But yeah,
I don't know if this is a story I want you to broadcast or not. But we had 2 days off, so I flew home to see my wife and daughter, and we had just moved into a new house while I was away. So I was kind of like unpacking boxes and putting shit together. And at one point, I found myself, Dr. Phil was on, so I put it on, and then we had just bought curtains, and I'm like, well, these curtains, you know, they need to be ironed, obviously, so I was ironing curtains while watching Dr. Phil, and I just had, like, this eureka moment of, like, this is my life right now. Like, I'm enjoying myself. Just yesterday, I was at Warped Tour in Albuquerque, New Mexico, and now I'm ironing curtains watching Dr. Phil, and it's a strange, strange thing that's going on.
But that's, like, the double life we live.
Yeah.
Which is really funny, because people don't understand that.
No, I think
it's humorous to you even, and you're doing it.
Yeah.
Think about what a kid that sees you on stage thinks.
Yeah,
you know?
That's the thing. I it's one of those guilty pleasures, but it's also kind of humanizing. I mean, it really is. It's not like this ideology of like, oh, the people that are on the road are always living a crazy life and they're doing insane things that I wish I could be doing. There's a really good chance that people that are on the road just really wish they could find some sort of normality. But that being said, I think that it's really, really dangerous to keep comparing the life of a band person to a quote-unquote normal life. And when you kind of run these parallels and go, well, I'm 36 years old, I probably should be having a job with a nice little nest egg for the family, there's no should be anything. You know what I mean? I feel like if you're going to be in a band, just do it 100% all the time. And then when you're home, do that 100% all the time. And I think that people drive themselves crazy trying to find a balance between what they're doing and what they think they should be doing. And you really take things for granted when you do that.
Yeah. The problem, though, with that is, of course, that you're not home. So there's things that fall by the wayside.
Yeah.
You know, like
yeah.
over my career, I guess you can call it, like, relationships have come and gone.
Of course.
With family too, you miss every one's birthday, all your friends' birthdays.
Yeah.
Friends are like, oh yeah, we're going to like up to the cottage this weekend.
Uh-huh.
Can't go. We got a one off in Quebec or something.
Right.
You know, so that's the struggle, I think.
Uh-huh.
Which is what makes, you know, band dudes or whatever like long for that.
Yeah.
And fight with themselves and not be able to do things.
Yeah.
100% one way or the other.
Yeah,
you know?
But we chose, I mean, I guess there's a part of us that subconsciously chose this as much as there is that this was kind of imposed on us, and we didn't really have a choice, and that this was like our calling to do something like this. So yeah, it's disappointing that, you know, you're not going to get home to see your kid's first word, you know, being said. That absolutely sucks. It absolutely sucks. But you know, you don't go into it when you're 18 years old like we did, thinking that far in the future. We're still here, you know? And I really have to...
Point.
If I think about the things that I'm missing, it's just going to drive me crazy, you know? And it's going to make me not take advantage of the opportunities I have out here on the road, you know? And it's not to say I miss it. I miss it any less, you know? I really got to focus on what I'm doing at the moment rather than thinking about what I should be doing.
Sure. Well, it's funny. I bought your book.
Oh, thanks.
And I'm about a third of the way through it.
Okay.
And so I was reading it on the plane on the way here. And it's funny. I bring this up. I didn't want to bring this up so early in the interview, but there's something that you wrote that like right away stuck with me that's kind of like what we're talking about. I'm just looking through my fucking notes here and...
Oh, it's Dr. Phil until you find it.
So the one idea you talked about in your book, which is sort of like what we're talking about, is the idea that a dead end isn't as hopeless as something that goes on forever.
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember that?
Yeah.
You know, it's near the beginning of the book.
Yeah.
And that, like, really struck a chord with me for some reason, because we can relate. We're almost the same age. I'm 35. I think you're 36.
Yeah.
We've been in bands for about the same amount of time. And does it ever come to a point where you're just like... Am I going to do this forever? When is this going to stop?
Yeah, yeah. And you know, before we were doing this, we were talking about how, you know, we've been doing Warped Tour, and you think it's always going to be your last one, and it's not. You know, then you find yourself doing it again the next year, and yeah, that's a concern of mine, but it's not. There's no race to finish, really. I mean, this is an every time I die journey through life. You know, there's never been one before, and there will never be another one after it.
Yeah.
So, you know, these rules that we impose on, like, how long a band career should last, that doesn't apply to anybody. Everyone's on their own trip, and I feel like if I'm not through with it yet, there's a reason I'm not through with it yet. I haven't touched the right person. That, not physically, that's not what I mean. I mean, our music hasn't done what it's supposed to do yet, and when it does, we will never know, and that's okay, but then things will conclude.
Right. But there's always that whole thing of, like, when a band puts up, like, Lifetime, they put out their second record, it's amazing.
Yeah.
They don't even tour. It's just like they went out on top. Like,
yeah.
You know?
I agree.
Like Peyton Manning, you know?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
So that, is that something that, is that just romanticized, do you think?
Yes, absolutely.
Because I think that's better than just, the shows get smaller and smaller. Less people give a fuck.
Yep.
Oh, can't afford a bus anymore. We're back in a van.
Right.
That starts becoming demoralizing.
It's also delusional, too, to continue on under those circumstances when you know in your heart that something is over. It's like being in a bad marriage, you know? It's,
right.
You know that you're not happy. You know that it's not working. And you're continuing on because of these implications that if you don't do it, you're weak. If you don't do it, you're dishonest. If you don't do it, you're this, you're that. I mean, so many of the things that we do are based on the possible perceptions of people that we don't know. You know what I mean? Everything we do is kind of guided by the idea of, what are these strangers going to think about me if I do this? If I quit this band, what are all these people I've never met possibly going to think? And when you start putting your life in those contexts, in the hands of people you've never met, and the possible ideas that might generate in their brains, and realize that if that's the guiding force, that you're out of touch with yourself, you know? You really need to be honest with yourself. And there's this guy in Buffalo, I'm not going to say his name, he's a total anomaly in the way that I feel that life should work with being a creative person or a musician or artist and things. And when things aren't working, you have to give up. You really have to just know that quitting isn't necessarily a bad thing, that there are other lessons to be learned somewhere else, and you go on in a different avenue. And this kid he can't read the signs. He won't read the signs. He's a musician, and he's plugging away, and he's working harder than any musician I've ever met, and it has not paid off whatsoever. And it's like you feel bad for him because you go, oh my God, he's working so hard, and a lot of people don't have that ethic, and he does. Why isn't the universe or whoever rewarding him with something?
Right.
And he's just digging a hole. And he's just, the harder he works, it's just digging a hole. So I don't really know why that's happening, but if I had to guess, I would say it's because he's not being honest with himself. And there's a truth that he knows that it's too ugly to face, that it's just not his calling. And I think that when you realize that your time is up doing whatever you've been doing, just be honest and go ahead. People have this horrible idea that quitting means you're a terrible person, and it doesn't. It means you're on to a next lesson. You've graduated, you know?
Yeah.
So I think that's how people should look at it.
Yeah, that's kind of deep. But I mean, that being said, here we are on the Warped Tour.
Yeah.
Almost at the end.
Yeah.
And this is Every Time I Die is how many
eighth,
now?
Eighth.
Number eight?
Yeah, and it's very cyclical. And I mean, if I could tie it into to scale somehow, it's, you know, these cycles that we're going through that we'll only get out of them if we're honest with ourselves and if we take a lesson away that can kind of graduate us to that next level. And I was just talking about this with Greg from Dillinger this morning. The news came out that they're doing one more touring.
Oh, I didn't hear that.
Yeah, they're doing one more touring cycle and then they're breaking up. And I was like, Greg, I'm like, this. It's sad to read, but I'm like, congratulations, because it's you're onto a next level, you know. And he's like, this is nice. Everyone's been acting like it's the worst news they've ever heard. He's like, but that's how I like to think about it too. It's like I'm onto a next thing, and that's a really, really freeing experience to be like, okay, I'm done with this. Now I'm gonna do something else.
That's an end of an era, though, man.
Like, oh, my God.
When Dillinger came
sad.
Out, there was like, there's nothing ever like that before.
Nope.
And there probably never will be anything like that again.
And that's what's fun about being in a band and following a band, is that you see their trajectory and you follow them throughout. And you use a band like Lifetime as an example of a band that maybe went out too soon, maybe went out knowing exactly the right time to throw in the towel was. Mm-hmm. You know, and then you look at a band like Oscar Dillinger that's plugging away for 20 years and there's no gold bar standard with which to compare our lives to somebody else's life. And when you start doing that, it's just you're going to get jealous. You're going to get angry. You're going to get resentful. You know, I mean, having a brand new daughter who's 6 months, you know, or 8 months, depending, because she was 2 months premature. There's all these comparisons, and the doctors warn us, like, okay, she's 7 or 8 months old.
based on when she was born, but mentally she's 2 months later than that because she was so premature. So you can't do this comparison of she's not where other 7 or 8 month old babies are.
Wow,
you know,
yeah.
And it's a really, you know, that rule,
an analogy to make there.
That rule should follow you your whole life.
Right,
like it's your thing. It's your life. It's not. There's no guidebook. You know, unless you're.
But there's always that late bloomer thing that everyone talks about. Everyone knows it's real.
Uh-huh.
I was the opposite. I was like always. I always felt smarter than everyone else. I could get good grades without studying.
Yeah.
Then it caught up with me. By the end of the high school, I was like the dumb guy.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
So it's not always good to be ahead.
No, it never. It's
you
not.
Know?
Yeah, and that's people think they are. People think that if they're winning at something, as
right.
if there's one gold ring that everyone in life is trying to grab, and it's not that. We're all in our own lane, and there's a gold ring at the end of each lane. So
yes.
just get your own.
That's right. There's only one every time I die.
Yeah.
There will only ever be one every time
yes.
I die, and there will only be one of you.
Yes.
And one of me.
Yes. Enjoy it. Do everything you can to learn more.
That's great philosophy.
Thanks.
Wow.
But I think that being on Warped Tour for the 8th time, I'm wondering, have I finally learned what I need to learn? And like I said before we started recording, I'm not drinking this tour. This is the first Warped Tour I've ever done without a single drop of alcohol. And maybe that's what I was waiting for. Maybe that's what I needed. I don't know. To prove to myself that I don't need to drink to play shows. Who knows?
Now, like, doing this sobriety. I took a sober January this year, too.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, I drink every single day, pretty much. And I have for as long as I can really remember,
mm-hmm.
for a couple years at least. You know, occasionally I'll maybe go a day, I'll be like, oh, I didn't have a drink today.
Yeah.
Crazy. You know, so I don't know if that makes me an alcoholic or what that makes me.
No.
It's part of our lifestyle, almost.
It doesn't, yeah.
Which is hard to explain to people.
Right. It doesn't make you anything.
Like, I went to the doctor. This is funny. I got a new doctor, and they're filling out the form. It's like, do you smoke? Oh, no. Oh, that's good. Do you do drugs? I'm like, oh, not really. Oh, that's good. What are drinking? How many drinks do you have in a week?
Week? Like 30?
Yeah. I'm like 50?
Yeah.
And his face just drops. He's like, no one's ever said that before. I'm like, well,
yeah, because,
I mean, you're my doctor. I'm going to be honest with
of
you.
Of course.
But like, yeah, because I don't know, maybe 50.
Right, absolutely, because there are contexts for what a normal person should be drinking. This is not, it doesn't apply to us. It doesn't apply to a touring band, you know?
Yeah.
You're not an alcoholic if you drink 50 beers when you're on tour. That's actually a mild drinking week, to be honest, you know?
Right, especially like when you're back behind the trailer pounding Bud Lights, like,
and it's
on
free.
Warped Tour.
I mean, the problem is not how many drinks did you have, but what did you do when you had all those drinks? If you're like, well, I beat the shit out of some people I don't know, and
right.
I lost $200 that I needed to feed my family, then they'd be like, okay, you got a fucking problem.
Right.
But if you're like, I don't know, I had some laughs, and then I went to sleep really well.
But with you, what's your decision to stop? Were there issues?
Well, it started off when Zuzana was born, and I realized that I couldn't be hungover and get up at 3 o'clock in the morning to feed her, that she, I was literally the only thing she needed to survive, you know, me and her mother. So I had to stay pretty clear-headed for that time being, and once I did that, then that was 2 months was up, where I went on tour, and I was like, you know what, I feel pretty good, I guess, and I'm not as nervous being around people as I thought I would be, so I was kind of like, let's see what other lies alcohol was telling me, and
right.
the main one was that I couldn't play sober, and man, I'm loving playing sober, to be honest. It's I haven't lost my voice yet, which was a constant problem for me, so
oh, yeah.
I think that at this point in my life, at this age, it's really important that people that come to an Every Time I Die show get a good show, because I feel like there's a lot more involved now. You have like people that like Every Time I Die probably have to get babysitters. They probably maybe have to take a day off from work the next day. You know what I mean? They're older, and I understand
that's
that.
A good point.
So I don't want them coming out and making all these accommodations to have a night out with their wife or their girlfriend or their friends, and then I can't play because I'm blown out because I fucking, you know, was doing shots all night and screaming at a bar. So I think people that come out now are owed more, and it's more important to me that there's a better Every Time I Die show than there is another night of drunken revelry, I guess. But that's my trip, and that's not to say that sobriety is better. Sobriety doesn't work for everybody. It definitely didn't work for me until this point. I needed that experience of having a daughter and having someone actually rely on me, to kind of clear me up, you know?
So was it hard at first and then it got easier?
Yeah. It was almost impossible at first. It was really, like, shaking, like, oh, I smell it, you know?
Really?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah, it was really bad.
Is the rest of your band drinking around you, or are they trying, like...
No, they still drink it.
It doesn't matter?
Yeah, it doesn't
matter.
No, I think now I'm cool with it. I don't want to be the kind of person that tells anybody what to do or what they should do, you know? And that's why this, you know, taking this in a grander scope... Just the idea that I'm living in a country now where so many people are trying to tell other people what to do, who they can marry, what drugs they can or can't take. That's so absurd. Just live your life. Do what you got to do, you know?
Yeah, so, like, with your voice, you brought it up, like, you know, you've had some issues. Like, what was going on? You just think it was just basically the drinking and staying up late and partying that was affecting it?
Yeah, I think it was just that. I don't know how exactly. I don't know the science behind it, but... I was going to minute clinics like once every 3 weeks, 2 or 3 weeks, and, you know, getting these steroids, which would make me think that I was better, and I would feel better, and I would feel good that I felt better, so I'd blow it out even more, so that it was just this constant game of catching up, you know?
I don't even know what that is. What is these, like, what steroids do you take?
It's called prednisone. It's this pill that just, it really just kind of boosts your... I don't even know. Well, confidence for one, because it makes your throat not hurt, and then so you think your voice is better, but it's really not. It's just this. It's just a placebo, pretty much. That, you know, you feel better, you can talk clearer. But yeah, then I'd get on stage and I would only think that I was better, but it was still like kind of just playing a trick, and then I'd blow it out even more. So I don't know. Yeah. Once I stopped drinking and, you know, I stopped getting involved with the late night partying stuff, it was. My voice is bad.
Yeah, it's crazy. It's funny because most people are the opposite. I think I party more now than I ever have, and I drink more, and I stay up later and everything.
Yeah.
But I don't know if it's just something that I figured out how to sing or stamina or whatever.
So,
but when I was younger, even we were playing headline sets of like 10 songs, like really short. And I would like never drink before.
Uh-huh.
I would go to bed. Like I was way more like careful.
Yeah.
And I still had vocal problems. And now it's like I feel almost like, God, I got to knock on wood somewhere, but almost like invincible at times.
Dude, absolutely.
So it's interesting that with you, maybe the opposite.
Yeah.
Like, you're starting to get more worn out as you get older.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's just, I didn't expect it. I definitely didn't stop drinking in order for that to happen. It was just a very, very fortuitous side effect, you know. And once I realized that, and, you know, I was talking to some friends and, you know, just saying that, I feel better on stage. I feel my voice is better and clearer and stronger. And, you know, I had a friend be like, yeah, man, it sounds like way better. He's like, no offense, but that last time I saw you, he's like, it was bad. Jeez. And I'm like, Jesus, why didn't you tell me that?
It's
why
like
didn't anybody
say
just
in
wake
Germany.
Me up? It does sound like your last show, not so good. Why? Yeah.
That's usually the other way around, though. Last show, much better.
All right.
Much better.
Right. The one, I had an interview with somebody from France the other day, and he goes, so this new record, did you take songs you wrote 5 years ago and put them on? I'm like, what? Does it sound like that? And he's like, no. You had to clarify, but I actually said, I'm like, that sounds like a question from a German, not a Frenchman.
Pretty funny, yeah.
Humorless Germans. Harsh.
They can be
honest,
very, very brutal.
Yeah.
Which,
humorless.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. I saw you guys play at the Danforth with the Used, like...
Oh, yeah.
I don't know how long ago that was. I thought you said it great.
Thanks.
Fucking great. So,
yeah. No, I appreciate it.
I was
the same way as you. I felt invincible. There was a while there where I felt invincible, but every week or two, it would just catch up with me, and I would be destroyed. And then I have three or four shows where it was awful, and then I'd get back to where I was, but, you know.
Yeah,
this happens. It happens.
That's, you gotta learn your body. And when you say like you have trouble with your voice, is it like more screaming or is it more singing?
Screaming. I felt like singing I could do no matter what.
Yeah.
Yeah, which is strange because even when I couldn't scream or couldn't talk, I could still hit the singing parts.
Interesting. Yeah.
It is interesting.
I've heard complete opposite.
I know.
People,
me too.
And I don't know what weighs what. And
I don't either.
I felt like I've had both happen to me too.
Yep.
Where I've been like, oh God, my voice, and I like just can't hit a note to save my life.
Yep.
And then where it's like I try to scream and like nothing comes out.
Yeah. It's strange. There's no rules. There really aren't. It's just, you know, you're learning as you go. So whatever works.
Yeah. And I remember like watching that. Well, I saw Melissa Cross
for
a couple lessons, and I saw you on like the DVD and stuff.
Yeah.
And did you use any like that technique or anything?
No. No, I didn't.
No. Okay.
I think that more than anything else, what Melissa Cross did for me was give me the confidence to be a front man in a band. I don't know if anything that she taught me really worked or helped. I didn't necessarily follow her instructions as to the warming up techniques because I was a fucking... I was a narcissist. I'm like, I don't fucking... Nobody can tell me what to do. I don't fucking... I'm in this fucking band. I'm fucking doing it. I'm fucking 20 years old. I'm on top of the world. But yeah, that was her... That was the confidence that I had because she gave that to me. And it was just like mental. Total mental. And I think that... I think that, you know, as long as you believe that you're good, you're good.
That's funny. I never thought about it. But like, I saw her for... I went to New York... I saw her like for four lessons or whatever over like 2 days. And yeah, I didn't really learn anything. Uh-huh. Like I remember her telling me this really funny thing where she took a Shure mic, like an SM58.
Yeah.
She plugged it into like a little mini Fender guitar amp.
Yeah.
And she was like doing screaming.
Uh-huh.
And then, but it was like, it was basically like, I don't know if I can do it properly on the microphone. It was just like, if it would be like if someone that doesn't know how to scream like pretends and they just go, okay. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, the whisper screams, yeah.
Like someone would do if they were in their car maybe and they, with their family.
Yeah.
So she was doing that.
Yeah.
And I was like, but that's like not going to work for me. That's like quiet.
Right.
She's like, oh, no. So she turns the amp on and she takes the mic, literally cups the mic and goes,
yeah.
Like that. And, that's it. That's what you do.
The trick.
I'm pretty sure like the dude from Lamb of God is not doing that.
Right.
So that was funny. But the confidence thing, you're right. I remember I go in this New York City apartment and whatever and studio thing, and she's like, I got your record. It's amazing.
Yeah.
I was like, what? I'm amazing?
Right. That was it. That was like the first. It was like a. And if you had like any. If you have any daddy issues, go to Melissa Cross because she will be like, I'm so proud of you. Everything you've done. Oh my God. It just like warms your heart. And she, you know, there was a lot of techniques that. Just sort of the things like to envision when you're singing was a big help of she had this technique called over the pencil.
Yeah, where, I remember that.
You'd put this pencil in your mouth, you know, bite on it, and then try to sing and envision the words going over the pencil instead of under it or through it. And then you take the pencil away and you still kind of sing like that. And it, you know, it becomes, it carves a path in your brain. And you go, okay, I'm going to think of this every time I do it. And I do. That I absolutely still do. But that's not a warm-up technique. That's just a mental thing while you're performing.
Yeah.
So it's a lot of mental things. And she was more like a little like guru than she was a vocal instructor.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
But I'm not discrediting her.
I'm sure for a lot of guys, it's... Yeah. Like a lot of guys swore by
absolutely,
like, the stuff they
and she, from
her,
so. She knows what she's doing. She has a science to it, but for me, the stuff I took away was more the mental stuff.
Nice.
Yeah.
So I want to talk a little bit about the early days of ETID. We grew up. A lot of people might not know this, but we grew up very close together.
Yes, we did.
I'm from Oakville, Ontario.
Yep.
Which I know you probably played the Pine Room.
The Pine Room,
times.
And we also played a place called. Piggin? No, I don't think every time I did, but I went to a show called the Piggin Whistle. Does that sound familiar?
Yeah, I think they did like a couple shows, I remember, but I never went there.
Yeah.
But I mean, Buffalo, what part of Buffalo are you actually from? Like, where you
grew up in West Seneca, which is a suburb about 20 minutes away, but then I moved
like
into
the Peace Bridge kind of?
No, it's the opposite, east.
Oh, okay.
It's kind of
okay.
East, yeah. But then I moved to the city when I was like 18, and I kind of hopped around apartments since then. So
okay,
I was
right
downtown.
Yeah,
right
but
by
anyways,
the Peace Bridge.
We grew up very close together, and the scene back then in the like late '90s, let's call it, was like pretty fucking rad.
Yeah, it was so rad,
and it was really cool because we'd have bands from like this foreign country of you know, they're from like they're from Tonawanda, they're from Lockport, New York, and shit, and we'd be like, that's so exotic,
right?
And they'd come up and. And, you know, it was really cool that we had this scene, and I'm sure for you guys, like, coming across the border in Canada was probably pretty cool, too.
It was awesome. I'll tell you what else was funny, too. I remember, like, talking to Chris Gray from New Day Rising one time when we were little. And he's like,
Chris,
yeah,
great dog.
Oh, he's great. And he's like, yeah, we got a show in London. And I'm like, whoa, London, England. And I didn't realize until later he was talking about London, Ontario. I didn't know there was a London, Ontario for many years because there was no internet.
That's funny. Yeah, it's true. Yeah, like back in those days, like, First of all, you guys didn't have any fucking visas to cross the border, did
no,
you?
No, no.
You just drove across and said, we're a band, and they said, fine?
Dude, pre-9/11 was a whole, I mean, it was, yeah. There was one time where I remember me and my friends drove up, because you have to be 19, that's the drinking age in Canada. So we drove up when we were 19, to go drinking, and we were coming back, and my friend who was driving reeked of alcohol, and they're like, you smell like alcohol. And he goes, I stepped in some gasoline. And they go, okay, go ahead. That was the excuse. They just didn't give a shit about anything.
Nuts.
Anything. Yeah. But
so
yeah,
nuts.
We didn't have visas. No.
No,
we just
no. It's just like wild. Yeah. But we had such a like crazy scene. And, but I really felt like it was there was this weird push and pull between Toronto and Buffalo. Like it was like the Buffalo bands were kind of like looking up to the Toronto bands.
Oh,
and
yeah.
The Toronto bands were looking up to the Buffalo bands.
Yes.
Like, I remember the first time, like, Buried Alive came up and they played in Oakville. So I think this is like their second show, maybe.
Uh-huh.
And they fucking rolled up with, like, Mesa Full Stacks.
Yeah.
And, like, and I'd never seen, like, a hardcore band like that before, man.
Yep.
And they just, like, blew the fucking roof off. And, like, after that, you know how many, like, tough guy, double time bands formed?
Yeah.
And then I'm sure, like, and maybe I'm putting words in your mouth, but I'm sure, like, back then when Grade would come over, or New Day Rising, those bands would come over, they would influence it.
Yes.
And, like, the one thing about our bands, I feel like in Canada, we had more, like, singing bands.
You did. That was huge for me, because I loved that, and that was, like, a huge part of the attraction was that you could sing in a heavy band. I hadn't heard that before, you know?
Well, Grade was the ultimate.
Yeah, they were absolutely.
And what we do is, like, if Grade wasn't a band, my band would never be a band.
Yeah, but if Grade wasn't a band, I wouldn't have kept pursuing more bands like that and gotten deeper into the hardcore scene. It was because I was looking for stuff like that, you know, and it was awesome. It changed the way that I thought about heavy music.
Absolutely, yeah. So when, like, because I mean, I haven't listened to your first record in a very long time.
That's okay.
Is there is there even singing on that record?
Yeah, I feel like I nervously stuck a singing line in one of the songs, one or two of them. Nothing I was doing confidently, but it was just like, here we go, let's try this. You know, I mean, I didn't know really what I was doing, and we're writing things in the studio, so. God, I can't remember. But I knew that it was something I wanted to do, and I knew that it was just more honest for me, and I liked singing. I liked that catch. I liked having something to latch onto, you know,
absolutely.
When I was listening to heavy music. Yeah,
absolutely. Well, I remember, like, you know, I was talking to somebody about your band, and I've loved your band for a long time, and somebody said, like, love Every Time I Die, but I just wish Keith didn't change his vocal style on every record. And I thought about it, and I was like, at first I was like, no, and then I was like, wait, maybe he's got a point.
Yeah?
Because, you know, like, your voice has definitely evolved.
Yeah, well, I'm a grown man now. I was fucking 18 years old when Every Time I Die started.
But I mean, like, when Hot Damn came out, it was, like, way, way different.
Yeah, but I was, I mean, well, we inarguably tour more than 95% of the band, so I'm using my voice a lot more often than a lot of other people, I'm sure, and I'm, you know, it's probably beaten to shit, you know, so it's going to change. It's not going to, you know, it's going to come down in tone and pitch, and yeah, and
but
I'm just growing
up. I don't even know if he meant it was getting worse. I just think he didn't like the change.
Yeah, well,
you know, and that's
people
that's
that don't like change can fucking, you know, I mean, just sit in their house and complain about the kids these days until they fucking have a heart attack. You know, like, if you don't evolve, what is the point of being alive? I mean, I can't understand why people are so against change. Like, everything, we don't like it. It's not up to us. Everything evolves. Language evolves. Fucking music evolves. Films evolve. Every form of art evolves. That's just what being on this planet is about. I mean, humans evolve. That's what happens. If you don't evolve with your art or your music, I'm not
sure.
Not to say that this is an art, but if you don't change what you're doing to suit the conditions around you, you're not doing anyone a service.
No, absolutely.
I don't know.
Absolutely.
That makes me mad. You just got me all pissed off.
Yeah, it's good. I like angry. Angry Keith is good. Now to make you less angry,
we're
going to talk about your new fatherhood.
Okay.
And I understand there was a lot of complications.
Very complicated.
You had to leave.
Yeah.
Jason from Let Live, I should say, so people know, came and filled in for you. That must have been probably really, really scary.
Yeah, it was easily the worst experience of my life. But at the time, you know, just the amount of uncertainty and confusion. that was going on was really a harrowing thing, and it just I've never felt so powerless in my life. I mean, and it's, and I mean, I'm not talking about like stuck in a traffic jam powerless. I'm talking like, what am I doing alive? What good? Like, what am I supposed to be doing now? What happens if the worst comes to fruition and I lose my wife and my daughter? You know, the things that I had to think about and kind of understand that I might have to plan for, I can't believe that I had to experience that. I can't believe that I had to watch those movies in my head of, okay, well, if I lose one, how do I deal with the other? You know,
right.
That sort of thing. That's, and I mean, really that heavy. Those are real things that were occurring that night, was we might lose both of them. And it was terrifying.
Now when everything was okay, you know, everything's okay now.
Yeah.
And the new Keith is, you know, if I can call you the new Keith, it's like you have, you know, you're not drinking now. Do you feel a lot different in your life? Like, was it a big feeling like you're like, oh shit, like this could have happened and it didn't.
Yeah.
So now, like, is there something that you learn from?
Oh yeah. I mean,
because a lot of people try and they don't, and
right.
they fall into their own ways, but it seems like you've legitimately.
Yeah. I mean, I kind of adapted out of necessity. You know, when she came into the world, I was, it was coincidentally, and simultaneously the best and worst moment of my life. I mean, it was this idea that I have a new daughter, but she also might not survive, and my wife might not survive. And, you know, the idea that I'm holding this baby, and, well, not even holding a baby, I can only put my hands on her. And, you know, as a father, you want to be able to know that you can promise your child that everything will be okay, and I couldn't do that because she had already suffered so much that, you know, to start the world in so much pain is a terrible thing, and you just kind of hope that they don't remember that and it doesn't stick with them. But, it definitely changed me, and it changed the way that I prioritize things that happen to me, and it changed the way that I deal with the unexpected, and that it's just, there's no way I could have planned for that, you know? There's no way I could have ever had a sort of emergency kit there ready to put into place if all of this happens. It was just, it did. And you just gotta have faith in something, you know? It definitely kind of fortified my belief that you can do things with your mind. You can think positively and affect change.
Yeah. I
won't go too far into it, but I do feel like there is a very powerful thing in faith and love, and it doesn't have to be in a god or anything like that, but it just has to be in the idea that the universe is kind of on your side. You know?
Well, the thing is, like, I'm not religious at all, and I don't know if you are. But whatever. Like, the one thing that always struck me about it is, like, there's certain medical things. Like, for example, people are like, "Oh, this can be caused by stress."
Mm-hmm.
It's like, well, what is stress?
Yeah,
stress isn't something like stress isn't a virus or
no.
a bacteria. Stress is just a thing that you feel.
Right.
So how can anything really be caused by stress if it's just something that's in your, like, a thought in your head?
Right.
Obviously there's some sort of physiological thing that happens because of it.
Yeah.
But if stress can do that, then could there be, like, the opposite of stress? Maybe that's love, or maybe that's, you know, whatever that is.
Yep.
So, like, I'm not ruling anything out.
Yeah.
But it's a thing where people are like, say, oh, it's a coincidence, or it's like bullshit.
That's so easy.
Not necessarily.
Yeah, that's so easy to say that oh, it doesn't mean anything, and sort of the universe kind of resolves itself in utter chaos. And I honestly believe the opposite. I think that everything moves towards order and intelligence. And I mean, on the most base scale, look at a child being born. For 9 months, these cells are going in an order that nobody's. What's doing that? What's putting them there? What's putting these cells in this order? There's some sort of unifying intelligent principle that's assembling these cells into a human being. You know, I didn't do that. Her mother didn't do that. The doctors didn't do that. The baby didn't do that. It was done. You know, it was just done. So, I mean, our lives begin with something like that. That's why when I say the most base scale, I'm talking about, like, the very beginning. The only reason we're able to think about how things get done is because the things did them themselves, you know, first. And that was it. And now here we are. Here we are ruling it out and being stubborn about the way we think about energy and consciousness.
Right,
and
I know.
And I feel like, you know, I think that once consciousness becomes a quantifiable field where we can measure it and we can measure the amount of thought and energy that we put into certain things in our lives and see how they affect each other, I think that we're going to really be missing a lot that science isn't going to answer. And I don't think it'll ever be answered until we start correlating consciousness into the equation. I mean, I'm kind of on a kick now because I just read this book called The Secret Life of Plants. But it talks about the intelligence of plants and how they communicate with each other and how they...
I was just fucking talking to somebody about that yesterday.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
It's amazing how they do this and how their roots, you know, will grow into the soil until they find they tap a mineral they need, and then the end nerves of the root will die and the new ones will grow that are capable of moving that mineral up to the leaves. I mean, it's just... It takes care of itself, and it has for millions of years.
I just had this conversation. He was talking about... This other guy was kind of a weird dude, but... nice.
Yeah.
He's telling me how some plants will put like a certain acid in them so that other plants can't grow, like as a protection,
yeah.
Like all this stuff that like I'm like I never heard of that before.
Yeah, acacia trees when there's predation in the area and they're being fed on or ruined or chopped down, nobody knows what it is, but all the other acacia trees downwind start closing up. Like they're closing up shop,
yeah.
So that like no predators will want to eat them or see them as attractive and cut them down or anything, and they communicate with each other and you know, I mean, it's just now you look at the course of human history, just a few hundred years ago, Americans didn't think black people had a consciousness. We treated them like animals, and now we're okay. That was so how did we ever let that happen? How did we ever convince ourselves that another form of human being couldn't have the same soul that we do based on the color of their skin? Okay, so we're hoping to move past that. Unfortunately, Trump is sort of putting that back into play. But now we're like, okay, people are, and I'm talking about on the historical cosmic scale, just a blink of an eye later, now we're like, well, maybe animals actually have a soul too, and we're starting to respect animals as living things.
Right.
So we're not eating them as much, and we're not making things out of them as much. The next step is plants. Then we're going to be like, holy shit, this fucking tree has a life and it communicates with other trees. How have we just been chopping them down? And you know what I mean?
It's not that crazy to think. But yeah, man, like you even think back to, I don't know, 50 years, which is 50 years is nothing in terms of like the age of even how long people have been around, right?
Yeah.
How much things have changed. It's wild.
Yeah.
And people, I hear people think like walk around, especially younger kids and stuff, they just kind of feel like, oh, well, we already know everything.
Right.
There's no fucking way we know everything.
We know less than we ever have because there's more problems being approached.
In the 1950s, they thought that.
Right.
There was a car driving down the street.
Yeah.
They're like, you see that shit?
Yeah, we got it.
It's never going to get better than that.
How is it going to change? How is it going to get better than a car? Yeah, well, I don't know. We're in space now.
Like the first airplane that ever took off, people were like, well, that's it.
That's got to be it. We have not even begun to scratch the surface of what we're capable of.
No.
And I really feel... Like I said, science is great, and I totally, I back it, and obviously I believe in proof and evidence, but I think there is something underlying all of science that people like Neil deGrasse Tyson have shut themselves off of, and I think it's unfortunate because there's a lot of things that can't be explained with the tools that our feeble minds have created.
Yeah.
Even the smartest guys are still only using less than 10% of their brain, you know what I mean? So... To think that there's 100% of a brain waiting to be tapped somewhere, I mean, who knows what's going to happen then? I don't know if you've seen Lucy. Have you ever seen that movie? That lady could use like 100% of her brain. And she was.
No, it reminds me of that movie with Bradley Cooper, the kind of funny one. Oh, God. The name escapes me.
Wedding Crashers?
He takes like the drug and then he.
Oh, I know what you're talking about. Yeah. Yeah, I know
what you're talking about. It's kind of a bad movie, but it's like sort of entertaining.
Right.
Yeah, I can't remember the name.
Yeah,
I'm sure
what you're
people
talking
are
about.
Screaming at their radio right now the name of it. But they, that's what it reminds me of. And I mean, it's interesting, you know.
Why cut yourself off? There's so much. We don't even know. I mean, we can't even cure, a cold. And we think we know everything. There's so much basic stuff that we haven't figured out yet. We don't know why we're here. We don't know how this all started. We don't know. We don't know the first step we took. How can we really think that we are even beginning to understand where we're ending up?
Yeah, well, fatherhood is here, and fatherhood is here, and you're thinking about the world. I know you just said a few minutes ago that Every Time I Die tours 95 more than 95% of other bands. Is that going to change now? Are you going to dial back a little bit?
I think we're going to start. I don't necessarily know that we're going to dial back. I think the reason that Every Time I Die is still a functioning band is because we worked harder and not smarter. And I think that it was almost an intentional move to work really stupid. We would do stupid things that no other band would do because they were just stupid. We would drive to California from Buffalo to play one show. You know, nobody else was making that level of sacrifice because it's not a smart, you don't think it's a smart move. And you don't see the immediate payoff in doing stupid things. But in the long run, maybe that is a test to why we're still here, because we were doing stupid things. But I do think now we have to start touring a little smarter, just because we have kids involved. Jordan is a father too, and I am, and you know, so maybe now we don't tour as long, but we do. We're kind of talking about it right now, planning a tour where we stay in the same city for 3 days and then have a day off, and then go to the next city and do the, you know, 3 days there. And it's just a different approach.
No, totally, totally thought about doing that too. And like, now that you have so much material, you know, if you can extend it and do, you know, different albums or whatever, and you know, you guys have such a hardcore, like, rabid fan base that it makes sense.
The old models don't necessarily apply, but you learn that when you evolve as a band and you change your style or sound.
Well, one thing too that happened with you guys, and one of my favorite parts about your band is that you don't take yourselves too seriously.
Yeah.
At all.
Yeah.
And I don't know if you know what you're going to say when you get up there.
Oh my God, no. I wish I did, because I accidentally called Masked Intruders Masked Avengers the other day.
I love that band.
Yeah, they're awesome. I know the answer, but what I want to say doesn't always come out.
I've never seen them play before.
Yeah.
I just really like one of their records, and I've like really wanted to see them today, but I think they played. I think you just finished. I'm going to be in Pomona, so I'll see them then, but the whole humor aspect, it's like the time that you came up and the scene you came up in with, like, and this is going to be a blast from the past, but like, you remember like Fashion Core?
Hell,
and like,
yeah,
shit
I do.
Like that.
Yep.
18 Visions. Yep. And yep. Throw Down. Like, there was no element of humor at all in those bands. Like you're going to Hellfest. Like, I watched the Hellfest DVDs.
Yeah.
It's very serious. They're like straight edge, vegan.
Yeah.
Like, this is how you like should live.
Yeah.
We're, you know, there's nothing funny about those bands.
No.
Obviously, at some point, you just were like, this is my personality.
Yeah.
I'm going to let it shine through.
Yeah.
Like, tell me how that happened.
Yeah, that wasn't even really a conscious decision. I think it was just more of like, I am so out of place here because I'm not a tough guy. I was a skinny little kid. You know, we're kind of the opposite of what these bands are going for, and the fashionable aspect. We're a bunch of shitty dudes that fucking, you know, at that point in our lives, we were bowling a lot. You know, we were just eating terrible food, and we didn't really know what kind of music we liked because we were just kind of maturing. And
you're from Buffalo. We're from blue collar.
Yeah, but I mean, Buffalo is, you know, it's pretty much every day is like a Bruce Springsteen song. You know, I mean, it's just it was a town developed by blue collar workers that love to drink alcohol, and that was what our families did, you know. So I think that more so our humor was, for me, like really a defense mechanism. Like, I don't know how I'm going to deal with all this horrible truth of the scene I'm in and all these people that are scaring me to death. And you just got to make a joke about it. You know, you got to kind of cut yourself down before anybody else gets a chance to. So I guess that was it. But yeah, I mean, it was just one of those things of like, if I really let in how much uncertainty there is, and I really face that fact, it's going to be too overwhelming to even sort of cope with. So I just kind of, we just kind of took it show by show, and if we were nervous, then jokes would come out. But,
But you don't have any like shtick plan.
No,
any,
God,
like,
no.
Ever. You're like, yeah. So I guess it's interesting because somebody could go see you and be like, Keith wasn't really funny today.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, does anyone ever say that to you? Like, oh,
no, but
I come
down on myself really hard if I get through a set and I realize that no, I didn't like even make anybody laugh, because I do like the sound of people laughing at something I say. Obviously, it's just a good feeling to say something funny. But if I'll get through it, I'll be like, Jesus Christ, was I too serious? And I'm sitting here kicking myself now, thinking like, this interview's been really serious, and we haven't really around too much.
Not too much.
Yeah.
But I mean, we still got a little more time.
But maybe it's because I'm not nervous.
Maybe, right?
Yeah.
I don't know. It is funny though. Defense mechanism. All that stuff is interesting. And also, like, also going back to that time, like the Fashion Core thing. Like, and you know, we're on Warped Tour, so obviously we're reminded of this stuff. But like, when you guys first did Warped Tour, what year was it?
Boy, 2006.
Oh, so it was a little bit later.
Yeah, but that was like the first official Warped Tour, I think, that we were like advertised on. I want to say we did one before that. I'm so bad with dates, but we did one where it was very like DIY punk thing. We just showed up and played on the stage that they were just building for fun. But I think 2006 was our first announced
like
one.
Growing up, did you go to Warped Tour?
Yeah, I did. I went to about three or four growing up.
Yeah, because like, you know, it's more of a... Back then in the late 90s and stuff, the first one actually for me was 1997. Mm-hmm. And I've gone every year either playing. So this is number 20.
That's awesome.
I think it's awesome.
That really is awesome.
It's kind of intense. Yeah. So my 20th year going to Warped Tour. But back in those days, like, it was not... There was no metal,
no
hardcore bands at all. Like, there was nothing like that.
Right.
And I felt like you guys were kind of one of the first bands that really sort of was like, hey, like, we're going to do this, and we don't care. Like, From Out of Ashes was another one. They're like, we're going to do this, and we're going to be that odd band out with all these other, like, just, you know, skate punk bands and reggae bands or whatever. So when you guys went into it the first time or the first time you played, did you feel like the odd band out? And now, seeing how much it's changed... like, how do you feel now about it?
I definitely noticed that at first, and I didn't understand the scope of it until I was able to look at it in retrospect. But that's just the genius of Kevin Lyman of assessing a situation and sort of predicting the inevitable and then standing in front of it. Kevin Lyman knew that heavy music was on its way in. You know what I mean? And if he was using us as a representative for some reason to sort of start that wave with other bands, and we're, you know, we were on that, like, that front line of heavy bands coming in, that's awesome and that's a huge honor. But I think he just saw it approaching and knew that he needed to get in front of it. So, you know, we did that and we were the odd man out. But then, yeah, more and more started coming. And now the monster stages are just devoted to heavy bands, you know, and it's great. I think people will look at the Warped Tour and be like, oh, I don't want to fucking see any of those bands on the tour. That's not, it's not for you. The people that are saying that are like 30 years old. The Warped Tour is not for you. That's like going over to somebody else's house on Christmas morning and opening one of their presents and going, this isn't what I wanted. Like, no shit, it's not what you wanted. It's not your gift. This is for kids that are trying to get into new music.
Well, that's why they have that Not Dead Yet Fest or whatever.
Yes.
Which is like probably more my...
Absolutely. Mine too. But I'm honored to the fact that we're still considered to be on Warped Tour and we're still pulling our weight. I mean, that's a huge accomplishment, I think.
Absolutely, man. Absolutely, it is. It is. And like, what you guys have done and the longevity is like, you know, bands need to take notice of that. And whatever you guys are doing, you're, you know, it's been a special run.
I think our willingness to be stupid is
there you go. That's it.
Yep.
That's the secret.
There was
be stupid. Do stupid things.
There was a, I was reading this book about code breaking, and it was all about people like encrypting all these codes and how to crack safes and stuff and all, you know, how to get into people's emails. No, it wasn't like a tip, like how to break it. It was just how people had done it through history. And the one thing that the author says is that being stupid is the first thing that you have to do, because only stupid people are as excited about their 100th attempt as they were about their first. Like, only stupid people can keep failing and go, I'm going to do that one more time. You know, smart people go, that didn't work, I'm done. But stupid people go, I'm going to keep doing it. I'm going to do it again. Right. I'm going to do it again. I'm going to do it again. And then they find something, and it's the stupid people that you know, happen upon it.
Yeah, that's super, super interesting. Yeah, as I said earlier, like, I got your book.
Thank you.
I'm about 100 pages in out of 300 or whatever I got on my phone, so I don't know how many pages it really is.
243.
Okay, yeah. So I'm like a third of the way in.
Okay.
What, like, I guess you, I know you have a background in like, English and stuff like that, and you're a great writer, at least musically. What made you decide to write a book? How long did it take you, and are you going to write more?
It took me about 4 years from when I sat down and started writing things that would eventually become part of the book. I didn't sit down with the intention of writing a book at all. I was just sitting down and writing stories and kind of keeping a tour journal. But then I had this one sort of eureka moment of there was a pattern in the stories that I was writing, and I didn't realize it. And there was like a theme, and I was like, oh, this could be a good theme, which was just basically just an existential crisis. I mean, that's really, this is unabashedly a typical hero tale of its, you know, every hero story has the same like elements. It's departure, fulfillment, and return. That's what everybody that writes a hero tale does. It's what every like main character in a movie or story does. They leave, find something, and come home. So I think that really my take on that was to not have the fulfillment part in there. It was just the constant departure and return, and I think that that was really the moment of like, oh, wait a minute, this could be a book. It could be a book about someone that's never fulfilled. So then that was about 2 years of, once I kind of realized that, then it was another 2 years of actually writing a book and a year of editing. So, and yes, I would love to do it again.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think you should.
Thank you.
How much of the book is autobiographical?
A lot
yourself?
Of it. A lot of it. It's a lot of composite stuff that where I had to like put a bunch of people together. You know, and that was kind of one of the best things about writing it was that I had to make people up and I could base them on real people. And then I started realizing that like, oh my God, wait, my friend in California that I was going to use in this part is exactly like this guy I knew from Minneapolis. And I'm just going to combine those features. And I was like, holy shit, I'm living in a fucking... a circle. Like every I'm meeting the same people and they're coming back as different people, and you know that's a big thing to the character Ray is that these things happen in different forms.
No, I've loved what I've read so far, and like the when you describe Chet the sound guy,
yeah,
that's like kind of my favorite because it's literally like every sound guy.
It's a sound
like
guy.
That.
Yeah. Yeah. if you know a sound guy, you know them all. They're all crazy.
Yeah, that was really, really like that was kind of my favorite part.
Cool.
I guess you can pick and choose to like what you're admitting to by using like, oh well, maybe the story that happens to Raymond in the book, maybe I did that.
Right.
Maybe my friend did that.
Right.
Maybe it's completely fabricated.
Yeah.
But then there's always like this, like I'm reading it and I'm still picturing you.
Oh, I'm sure.
In my head.
Yeah.
And I'm picturing like, because especially when you bring up like Virginia Tech, where you actually went to school, it's like, well, you could have just used a different school.
Of course, of course.
You know, but you chose to sort of reflect yourself in it, too.
Also, because it was at the time when that happened, you know, when the shooting happened at Virginia Tech, it was, you know, obviously very unfortunate, but it was the beginning of there were a few major events in my life that really changed the way I thought about the world. And when I found out about the shooting at Virginia Tech, that was one of the major, like, puberty moments of I'm changing my thoughts are changing about the world around me. All of a sudden, I'll try not to go off.
I totally
of course.
Get it though.
There's a very specific point in someone's life when they feel that the world is working for them and the world is working against them, and that's when adulthood happens. It's when you go from this is my world, everything is here to accommodate me, to holy shit, everything is out to get me. You know, and that's a shift from childhood to adulthood. That finding out about the shooting at Virginia Tech was my moment of I am now an adult. I fear everything.
Yeah.
I don't trust anybody. And that's like the death of your child. And that's a, you know, I mean that your inner child, which is a very tragic moment in people's lives.
No, I understand because it's something familiar to you.
You've
been there where the shooting took place.
I mean it was the buildings that I had classes in. It was a very sad, sad time for me. So that I needed that to be in Ray's story too, because Virginia Tech changed the way that his world operated because his teacher did that to him.
Yes.
You know what I mean? So I took all the anger from the Virginia Tech shooting and put it into Ray's anger dealing with the Virginia Tech teacher.
Yes.
So that's what it was.
Totally.
You know, so I needed it to be that.
Totally. It's also like when he finds out about fingering.
Right. Another moment. But yeah, he has a lot of those moments.
That's another moment, which was...
That was a sexual awakening.
Very well. I love the way you
Thanks.
Wrote that. That was fucking classic.
Thank you.
So yeah, everybody, if you haven't checked out Keith's book, Scale, go get it. I just went on my phone, literally was like, I think I can buy a book on here. And I found an app called iBooks, and
boom.
You go.
There it is.
I had it. In a matter of minutes. So
check it out.
I won't take up too much more of your time.
I'm sorry, I know it's getting hot back here, but I had to turn the fan off so it wasn't too loud.
No, it's okay. I'm all right.
Okay.
But we got to talk about the new record that's coming out in September.
Yes.
What's it called?
Low Teens.
Low Teens? Is that like a 13, 14, 15? Is that,
those are the lowest.
What's that title
It actually
referencing or mean?
It came about because we were recording it in Buffalo in the winter. It was freezing, and the weatherman said the temperature was in the low teens, and we were like, oh, that's a cool name. That's a cool phrase.
Yeah.
And then, as phrases tend to do, they take on a meaning of their own, and then we're like, oh, well, it could maybe also mean like this sounds like There's a lot of songs on it that like are almost alternative sounding, like the stuff that we're kind of adapting that we listened to when we were growing up. And once you hear the record, I think you'll know what songs I'm talking about that sound almost alternative, the music behind it.
Interesting.
Yeah, it was the stuff that we listened to when we were depressed teenagers, which I think most of us were. Yeah. If we're still here today, chances are we were depressed teenagers.
So is the music, like musically, is the record a big departure?
No, not necessarily. I think it's a step, you know, but I don't think it's necessarily towards or away from anything. It's just the next part of it. But I did realize that after we had tracked a song called Two Summers, it was the first Every Time That I Sung without screaming in it. So
oh, yeah.
There's that on the record. There's a song without screaming
is
in it.
Is it a, like, is it still... You say you didn't realize. Is it a slow jam or is it like still kind of a rocker?
It's a rocker.
It just
yeah.
doesn't have sing-
It's a
it
rocker just doesn't have screaming in it. And I didn't intend for that. And that's how I know that I like, you know, when that was brought up, I was like, oh shit, should I go back and change it? And I was like, no, if I change it, then that's phony. It was an organic writing process where I didn't feel the need to scream. It didn't
it's
call
not like
for
the
it.
Label came to you
right.
and was like, we need a song without screaming so we can get it on the radio.
Yeah, yeah. No.
But people will think that's what it is.
I
don't know if it's a single or not. But
yeah, no, it's
will,
not. Yeah,
people will think that.
You know, I didn't even think about that because this goes back to what I was saying in the beginning. If you start thinking about the way that strangers might think about the stuff you do, it's going to make you dishonest and it's going to make you not enjoy your, you know, your art. So, yeah, you're probably right. People will think that. But if I had had that realization before, I don't know. Might have changed something. But as it stands, there's no screaming in it. And it wasn't to get it on the radio. It was just the way it happened.
Great. So, but the record comes out, what is it, September?
September 23rd.
23rd.
Yeah.
Pre-order's out.
Pre-order's out. And if you come to a Warped Tour and buy anything of, like, a t-shirt, you get a little card that you fill out. And then we'll email you the record for free when it comes out. It's sort of like
I don't know. I think I'm going to put this out on Monday. I don't know if Warped Tour will still exist or if it'll be over.
It'll be just about over.
Over. So
but we'll have the cards on the
days.
Way back. Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah.
Awesome. Well, hey, Keith, anything else
great.
To add? Anything else?
No, I feel
really
like I talked too much. Thank you. I feel like I talked too much.
The perfect amount.
Okay, good. I read something the other day online, and I tend not to read comments online, but when people like tag me in a photo of like the book that when they buy Scale, I'll typically like, oh, thanks for picking it up, you
sure.
know.
Yeah.
Somebody tagged me in it, so it caught my attention, and I guess maybe I was just having a bad day, and it was just talking shit about it, and it's like, I got this, but I'm only like 3 pages in, and I just think it's gonna he's too pretentious, and it's gonna ruin it for me, and it's like, man, I really get bothered when people think that it's a pretension thing, that writing a book is an act of being pretentious, because it's really not. It was just I was doing it just because I, you know.
It's because he had to look up every other word in a dictionary.
Yeah, but it's not a bad thing.
It's not a bad thing.
Yeah,
my mom very early on in my age, I'd say to my mom, what's this word mean? And instead of her just saying to me, oh well, it means this. Mm-hmm. Or I think it means this. She goes, let's go get the dictionary.
Good. It's a lesson.
We always
yeah.
would get the dictionary.
Right.
And still to this day, yeah. if I see a word I don't know, I get my dictionary.
And why
out.
Are people so coming and down so hard on that? Like, oh, I should have brought a dictionary. Like, maybe, yeah, I guess if you don't know, then look up a new word. It's
but
fun.
I do think it's funny that you're talking about this, because in the book, you talk about
yes.
fans reviewing.
Yes.
Where you're like, whatever is happening, you're at some party
yeah.
or something, and
yeah.
you want to you want to say, what do the real people think?
Yeah.
Not the critics.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
now it's funny. You're like, anyone with a fucking phone
yeah.
can
you ruin
know, cut
your
to the
day.
Core of you.
Yeah, ruin your fucking day.
And so it still bothers you, even after all these years.
It does, and I everyone wants to be like, no, that shit don't bother me. But yes, it does bother me, because you have to, I sort of look at like criticisms and things like that, though I try not to take in too much of it. I do need to understand like where I am positioned, and maybe, you know, the critics have something to say that's correct, and then I could learn from it and change. You know, maybe I wasn't doing something that I should have been doing. You know, it's just there's so much to learn about yourself. So I think that one of the hardest things to learn about writing a book is that people are just going to assume that just because you did it, it means that you think that you're like this fucking philosopher. And I don't think that at all. I just wanted to write a book because it was in my head and it was fun for me to do, you know. So it doesn't put me on a new level of anything. It's just I'm doing a band that wrote a book.
I don't know. Okay. People probably say the same thing about me starting a podcast.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm just,
but you can't listen
I just,
to it.
It's interesting
yeah.
to me.
Yeah.
Meeting new people. It's
right.
fun. Like, there's no... Right. I don't think I'm cooler than anybody.
Right, but people think you think you're cooler. And then it gets into this whole chess game of like, what are people thinking and what am I doing? How can I alter their thoughts? What can I do to make it seem like I'm not what they think I am? And it's just, man, perception is everything,
there
unfortunately.
Yeah, and if you're write a review on iTunes for the podcast if you like it, by the way.
Yes, please do, because I had a great time with this. This is awesome.
Well, dude, thank you.
Yeah,
thank
absolutely.
You very much, and yeah, enjoy the last few days of the Warped Tour.
Thanks,
got through
man.
Another one.
I did it.
And no drinking.
No
so
drinking.
Congratulations.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thanks,
appreciate
man.
It. Thanks, absolutely.
Keith. So there it is, my conversation with Keith. It was great speaking to him. Just such an intellectual dude, and just so much you can take away from having an hour conversation with him. And, you know, it's funny, we didn't really know each other before, despite growing up kind of in the same scene between Buffalo, Toronto, us being in the same circles. I never really met Keith before, and it's really great that this podcast, you know, I meet new people too. So now, you know, I'm proud to say me and Keith are friends now, and that's really one of the most awesome things that I get out personally of doing this podcast. If you like the show, please do me a favor, go on iTunes, write a review, preferably 5 stars, say some nice things. And if you don't want to do that, just tell a friend, tell your mom, tell your dad, tell your sister, tell your brother, anybody that likes music. I don't think it even matters if you necessarily know who the band is. If you're interested in music, how the music industry works, how singers sing, tell a friend, they could be really into it. And that's what helps this show grow and helps this thing get bigger and bigger. And I'm having so much fun. Next week, we'll be back with kind of an amazing episode, so make sure you're subscribed. Next week is a big one. I'm really, really jazzed about it. And as always, I will leave you with some music. I'm going to go with a song from Hot Damn, which to me, when Hot Damn came out, that Every Time I Die album, it really kind of cemented them as the heavy band in the scene. So here's the song that when I first heard it, I was like, oh shit, Every Time I Die is fucking here. This song's called Ebolarama. Here it is. On Lead Singer Syndrome. Peace and love. Boys, disappear from the hill. This time we put the ass in action. Please, drink some tea. Here's the beginning. And this one's been magic. When you die, there will be. Make up on a new set of cutlery. The livestock is not strong. They're all celebrating like heaven is on the cockroaches yet at the end of the world.